Chapter 5. You see, I was still looking for answers then. I still wanted to know why, as though somebody was going to answer that for me, as though any answer would be satisfying. Not then, but afterward, I started to think about time, and how it keeps moving and draining and flowing forever forward, seconds into minutes, into days, into years, all of it leading to the same place, a current running forever in one direction. And we're all going and swimming as fast as we can, helping it along. My point is, maybe you can afford to wait. Maybe for you, there's a tomorrow. Maybe for you, there's 1,000 tomorrows, or 3,000, or 10. So much time, you can bathe in it, roll around in it, let it slide like coins through your fingers. So much time, you can waste it. But for some of us, there's only today. And the truth is, you never really know. I wake up gasping, the alarm bringing me out of darkness as if it has brought me up from the depths of a lake. It is the fifth time I've woken up on February 12th, but today, I'm relieved. I switch off the alarm and lie in bed, watching the milky white light steal slowly over the walls, waiting for my heartbeat to go back to normal. A swath of sunlight ticks upward over the collage Lindsay made for me. In the bottom, she's written in pink, glittery ink, "Love you forever." Today, Lindsay and I are friends again. Today, no one's angry at me. Today, I didn't kiss Mr. Daimler or sit bawling my eyes out alone at a party. Well, not totally alone. I imagine the sun filling Kent's house slowly, frothing upward like champagne. As I lie there, I start making a mental list of all the things I'd like to do in my life, as though they're still possible. Most of them are just plain crazy, but I don't think about that. Just go on listing and listing like it's as easy as writing up what you need from the grocery store. Fly in a private jet, eat a fresh baked croissant from a bakery in Paris, ride a horse all the way from Connecticut to California, but stay in only the best hotel rooms along the way. Some of them are simpler. Take Izzy to Goose Point, a place I discovered the first and only time I'd ever tried to run away. Order the fat feast at the diner, a bacon cheeseburger, a milkshake, and an entire plate of cheese fries, and eat it without stressing, like I used to do on my birthday every single year. Run around in the rain, have scrambled eggs in bed. By the time Izzy slinks into my room and hops up into bed with me, I'm actually feeling calm. "Mommy says you have to go to school," Izzy says, headbutting my shoulder. "I'm not going to school." That's it. That's how it starts. One of the best and worst days of my life starts with those five words. I grab Izzy's stomach and tickle her. She still insists on wearing her old Dora the Explorer t-shirt, but it's so small it leaves the big pink stripe of her belly, the only fat on her body, exposed. She squeals with laughter, rolling away from me. "Stop it, Sam! I said stop it!" Izzy is shrieking and laughing and thrashing around when my mom comes to the door. "It's 6:45. She stands in the doorway, keeping both of her feet neatly aligned just behind the flaking red line from all those years ago. "Lindsay will be here any minute." Izzy slaps my hands away and sits up, her eyes shining. I've never noticed it before, but she really does look like my mom. It makes me sad for a minute. I wish she looked more like me.
"Sam was tickling."
"Sam's going to be late. You too, Izzy."
"Sam's not going to school, and I'm not either."
Izzy puffs out her chest like she's prepared to do battle over it. Maybe she'll look like me when she's older. Maybe when time starts marching forward again, even if I get swept out with it like litter on a tide. Her cheekbones will get high and she'll have a growth spurt and her hair will turn darker. I like to think it's true. I like to think that later on people will say, "Izzy looks just like her sister Sam." They'll say, "You remember Sam? She was pretty." I'm not really sure what else they could say. She was nice. People liked her. She was missed. Maybe none of those things. I push the thought out of my mind and return to my mental list. A kiss that makes my whole head feel like it's exploding, a slow dance in the middle of an empty room to really great music, a swim in the ocean at midnight with no clothes on.
My mom rubs her forehead. Izzy, go get your breakfast. I'm sure it's ready by now. Izzy scrambles over me. I squeeze the chub of her stomach and get one last squeal out of her before she jumps off the bed and dashes out the door. The one thing that can get Izzy moving that quickly is a toasted cinnamon raisin bagel with peanut butter. And I imagine being able to give her a cinnamon raisin bagel with peanut butter every single day for the rest of her life, filling a whole house with them. When Izzy's gone, my mom looks at me hard. What's this about, Sam? You feel sick? Not exactly. One thing that is not on my wish list is to spend even 1 second in a doctor's office. What then? There must be something. I thought Cupid Day was one of your favorites. It is. Or, I mean, it was. I sit up on my elbows. I don't know, it's kind of stupid if you think about it. She raises her eyebrows. I start rattling on, not really thinking about what I want to say before I say it, but afterward, I realize it's true. The whole point is just to show other people how many friends you have, but everybody knows how many friends everybody else has, and it's not like you actually get more friends this way, or, I don't know, get closer to the friends you do have. My mom smiles a tiny bit, one side of her mouth cocking upward. Well, you're lucky to have very good friends, and to know it. I'm sure the roses are very meaningful to some people. I'm just saying, the whole thing is kind of sleazy. This doesn't sound like the Samantha Kingston I know. Yeah, well, maybe I'm changing. I don't mean those words either until I hear them. Then I think that they might be true, and I feel a flicker of hope. Maybe there's still a chance for me after all. Maybe I have to change. My mom stares at me with this expression on her face like I'm a recipe she can't quite master. Did something happen, Sam? Something with your friends? Today I'm not so annoyed at her for asking. Today it strikes me as kind of funny, actually. I so wish that the only thing bothering me was a fight with Lindsay or something dumb Allie said. It's not my friends. I grasp for something that'll make her cave. It's Rob. My mom wrinkles her brow. Did you have a fight? I slump a little farther down into the bed, hoping it makes me look depressed. He dumped me. In some ways, it's not a lie. Not like he broke up with me, exactly, but like maybe we weren't ever serious, in the way I believed for so long. Is it even possible to go out with someone seriously who doesn't really know you? It works even better than I expected. My mom brings her hand up to her chest. Oh, sweetie. What happened? We just wanted different things, I guess. I fiddle with the edge of my comforter, thinking of all those nights alone with him in the basement, bathed in blue light, feeling sheltered from the whole world. It's not so much of a stretch to look upset when I think about that, and my bottom lip starts to tremble. I don't think he ever really liked me, not really, really. This is the most honest thing I've said to my mother in years, and I suddenly feel very exposed. I have a flashback then of standing in front of her when I was 5 or 6 and having to strip naked while she checked me all over for deer ticks. I shove down farther into the covers, balling up my fists until my nails dig into my palms. Then, the craziest thing in the world happens. My mom steps straight over the flaking red line and strides over to the bed like it's no big deal. I'm so surprised, I don't even protest as she bends over me and plants a kiss on my forehead. I'm so sorry, Sam. She smooths my forehead with her thumb. Of course you can stay home. I expected more of an argument and I'm left speechless. Do you want me to stay home with you? She asks. No. I try to give her a smile. I'll be fine, really. I want to stay home with Sam. Izzy has come to the door again, this time halfway dressed for school. She's in a yellow and pink phase, not a flattering combination, but it's kind of hard to explain color palettes to an 8-year-old, and has pulled on a mustard yellow dress over a pair of pink tights. She's also wearing big, scrunchy yellow socks. She looks like some kind of tropical flower. A part of me is tempted to freak out at my mom for letting Izzy wear whatever she wants. The other kids must make fun of her. Then again,
I guess Izzy doesn't care. That's another thing that strikes me as funny, that my 8-year-old sister is braver than I am. She's probably braver than most of the people at Thomas Jefferson. I wonder if that will ever change, if it will get beaten out of her. Izzy's eyes are enormous, and she clasps her hands together like she's praying. Please? My mom sighs, exasperated. Absolutely not, Izzy. There's nothing wrong with you. I'm feeling thick, Izzy says. This is made slightly unbelievable by the fact that she's hopping and pirouetting from foot to foot as she says it. But Izzy's never been a great liar. Did you eat your breakfast yet? My mom crosses her arms and makes her strict parent face. Izzy bobs her head. I think I have food poisoning. She doubles over, grabs her stomach, then immediately straightens up and begins hopping again. I can't help it. A little giggle escapes. Come on, Mom, I say. Let her stay home. Sam, please don't encourage her. My mom turns to me, shaking her head, but I can tell she's wavering. She's in third grade, I say. It's not like they actually learn anything. Yes, we do, Izzy crows, then claps her hand over her mouth when I give her a look. My little sister, apparently not a champion negotiator either. She shakes her head and quickly stutters, I mean, we don't do that much. My mom lowers her voice. You know she'll be bugging you all day, right? Wouldn't you rather be alone? I know she's expecting me to say yes. For years, that's been the buzzword of the house. Sam just wants to be left alone. Want some dinner? I'll bring it up to my room. Where are you headed? Just want to be alone? Can I come in? Just leave me alone. Stay out of my room. Don't talk to me when I'm on the phone. Don't talk to me when I'm listening to music. Alone, alone, alone. Things change after you die, though. I guess because dying is about the loneliest thing you can do. I don't mind, I say, and I mean it. My mom throws up her hands and says, whatever. But even before it's out of her mouth, Izzy's charging through my room and his belly flopped on top of me, throwing her arms around my neck and screeching, can we watch TV? Can we make mac and cheese? She smells like coconut, as usual, and I remember when she was so small we could fit her in the sink to give her a bath, and she would sit there laughing and smiling and splashing like the best place in the world to be was in a 12-by-18 square of porcelain, like the sink was the biggest ocean in the world. My mom gives me a look that says, you asked for it. I smile over Izzy's shoulder and shrug, and it's as easy as that. Into the woods. It's weird how much people change. For example, when I was a kid, I loved all of these things, like horses and the Fat Feast and Goose Point, and over time, all of them just fell away one after another, replaced by friends and IMing and cell phones and boys and clothes. It's kind of sad if you think about it. Like there's no continuity in people at all. Like something ruptures when you hit 12 or 13 or whatever the age is when you're no longer a kid but a young adult. And after that, you're a totally different person. Maybe even a less happy person, maybe even a worse one. Here's how I first discovered Goose Point. One time before Izzy was born, my parents refused to buy me this little purple bike with a pink flowered basket on it and a bell. I don't remember why, maybe I already had a bike, but I flipped out and decided to run away. Here are the basic 2 rules of running away successfully. Number 1, go somewhere you know. Number 2, go somewhere nobody else knows. I didn't know these 2 rules then, obviously, and I think my goal was the opposite, to go somewhere I didn't know and then be discovered by my parents, who would feel so bad they'd agree to buy me whatever I wanted, including the bike, and maybe a pony. It was May and warm. Every day the light lasted longer and longer. One afternoon I packed my favorite duffel bag and snuck out the back door. I remember thinking I was smart for avoiding the front yard where my father was doing yard work. I also remember exactly what I packed. A flashlight, a sweatshirt, a bathing suit, an entire package of Oreos, a copy of my favorite book, Matilda, and an enormous fake pearl and gold necklace my mom had given me to wear on Halloween that year. I didn't know where I was going, so I just went straight, over the deck and down the stairs and across the backyard, into the woods that separated our property from our neighbors. I followed the woods for a while, feeling really sorry for myself and half hoping that some hugely rich person would spot me and take pity on me and adopt me and buy me a whole garage full of purple bicycles. But then, after a while, I got kind of into it, the way kids do. The sun was hazy and gold. All the leaves looked like they were haloed in light, and there were tiny birds darting everywhere and layers of velvet green moss under my feet. All of the houses dropped away. I was deep in the woods and imagined I was the only person who'd ever come this far. I imagined I would live there forever, sleeping on a bed of moss, wearing flowers in my hair and living in harmony with the bears and foxes and unicorns. I came to a stream and had to cross it. I climbed an enormous high hill as big as a mountain. At the top of the hill was the biggest rock I'd ever seen. It curved upward and out from the hillside like the pot-bellied hull of a ship, but it had a top as flat as a table. I don't remember much about that first trip other than eating Oreos one after another and feeling like I owned that whole portion of the woods. I also remember that when I came home, my stomach cramping from all the cookies, I was disappointed my parents hadn't been more worried about me. I was positive I'd stayed away for hours and hours and hours, but the clock showed I'd been gone less than 40 minutes. I decided then that the rock was special, that time didn't move there. I went there a lot that summer, whenever I needed to escape, and the summer after that. One time I was lying stretched out on top of the rock, staring at the sky all pink and purple like the stretch taffy at carnivals, and I saw hundreds of geese migrating, a perfect V. A single feather floated down through the air and landed directly next to my hand. I christened the place Goose Point, and for years kept the feather in a small decorative box wedged into one of the stone ridges running along its underbelly. Then one day, the box was gone. I figured it had been blown away during a storm and searched through the leaves and undergrowth for hours, and when I couldn't find it, cried. Even after I quit horseback riding, I climbed up to Goose Point sometimes, though I went less and less. I went there one time in sixth grade after all the boys in gym class rated my butt as too square. I went there when I wasn't invited to Lexa Hill's sleepover birthday party, even though we'd been partners in science class and spent 4 months giggling over how cute John Lippincott was. Each time I came back home, less time had passed than I expected. Each time I still told myself, though I knew it was stupid, that Goose Point was special. Then one day, Lindsay Edgecombe came into Tara Flute's kitchen when I was standing there, put her face into mine, and whispered, "Do you want to see something?" And in that moment, my life changed forever. Since that day, I'd never once been back. Maybe that's why I decided to take Izzy there, even though it's absolutely freezing outside. I want to see if it's still the same at all, or if I am. It's important to me for some reason, and besides, of all the things on my mental checklist, it's the easiest. It's not like a private jet's just going to park itself outside my house, and skinny dipping now will get me arrested or give me pneumonia or both. So I guess this is the next best thing. And I guess that's when it starts to hit me. The whole point is, you do what you can. "Are you sure this is the right way?" Izzy's bobbing next to me, wrapped in so many layers she looks like the abominable snowman. As usual, she has insisted on accessorizing and is wearing pink and black leopard-spotted earmuffs and two different scarves. "This is the right way," I say, even though at first I was positive we were in the wrong place. Everything is so small. The stream, a thin, frozen black trickle of water and cobwebbed all over with ice, is no wider than a single step. The hill beyond it slopes gently upward, even though in my memory it's always been a mountain. But the worst part is the new construction. Someone bought the land back here, and there are two houses in different stages of completion. One of them is just a skeleton, rising out of the ground, all bleached wood and splinters and spikes, like a shipwreck washed up onto land. The other one is nearly finished. It's enormous and blank-looking, like Allie's house, and it squats there on the hill like it's staring at us. It takes me a while to realize why. There are no blinds on any of the windows yet. I feel heavy with disappointment. Coming here was obviously a bad idea, and I'm reminded of something my English teacher, Mrs. Harbour, once said during one of her random tangents. She said that the reason you can never go home again, we were studying a list of famous quotes and discussing their meaning, and that was one of them, by Thomas Wolfe. You can't go home again. Isn't necessarily that places change, but that people do. So nothing ever looks the same. I'm about to suggest we turn around, but Izzy has already leaped across the stream and is scampering up the hill. Come on! She yells back over her shoulder, and then when she's only another 50 feet from the top, I'll wreath you! At least Goose Point is as big as I remember it. Izzy hoists herself up onto the flat top, and I climb up after her, my fingers already numb in my gloves. The surface of the rock is covered with brittle, frozen leaves and a layer of frost. There's enough room for both of us to stretch out, but Izzy and I huddle close together so we'll stay warm. So what do you think? I say. You think it's a good hiding place?
The best.
Izzy tilts her head back to look at me.
You really think time goes slower here?
I shrug. I used to think that when I was little. I look around. I hate how you can see houses from here now. It used to feel so remote, so secret. It used to be a lot different, a lot better. There weren't any houses, for one, so you really felt like you were in the middle of nowhere. But this way, if you have to pee, you can go and knock on someone's door and just ask. She lisps all of her S's. This someone just ask. I laugh. Yeah, I guess so. We sit for a second in silence. Izzy?
Yeah?
Do the other kids ever make fun of you? For how you talk? I feel her stiffen underneath her layers and layers.
Sometimes.
So why don't you do something about it, I say. You could learn to talk differently, you know.
But this is my voice.
She says it quietly, but with insistence. How would you be able to tell when I was talking? This is such a weird Izzy answer, I can't think of a response to it, so I just reach forward and squeeze her. There are so many things I want to tell her, so many things she doesn't know, like how I remember when she first came home from the hospital, a big pink blob with a perma smile, and she used to fall asleep while grabbing onto my pointer finger. How I used to give her piggyback rides up and down the beach on Cape Cod, and she would tug on my ponytail to direct me one way or the other. How soft and furry her head was when she was first born. That the first time you kiss someone, you'll be nervous, and it will be weird, and it won't be as good as you want it to be, and that's okay. How you should only fall in love with people who will fall in love with you back. But before I can get any of it out, she's scrambling away from me on her hands and knees, squealing, "Look, Sam!" She slides up close to the edge and pries at something wedged in a fissure of rock. She turns around on her knees, holding it out triumphantly. A feather, pale white, edged with gray, damp with frost. I feel like my heart is breaking in that second because I know I'll never be able to tell her any of the things I need to. I don't even know where to begin. Instead, I take the feather from her and zip it into one of the pockets of my North Face jacket. I'll keep it safe, I say. Then I lie back on the freezing stone and stare up at the sky, which is just beginning to darken as the storm moves in. We should go home soon, Izzy. It's going to rain.
Soon.
She lies down next to me, putting her head in the crook of my shoulder. Are you warm enough?
I'm okay.
It's actually not so cold once we're huddled next to each other, and I unzip my jacket a little at the neck. Izzy rolls over on one elbow and reaches out, tugging on my gold bird necklace.
How come Grandma didn't give me anything? She says.
This is an old routine. You weren't alive yet, bird brain. Izzy keeps on tugging.
It's pretty.
It's mine.
With Grandma nice?
This is also part of the routine.
Yeah, she was nice.
I don't remember much about her either, actually. She died when I was 7, except the motion of her hands through my hair when she brushed it, and the way she always sang show tunes no matter what she was doing. She used to bake enormous orange chocolate muffins, too, and she always made mine the biggest. You would have liked her. Izzy blows air out between her lips.
I wish nobody ever died, she says.
I feel an ache in my throat, but I manage to smile. Two conflicting desires go through me at the same time, each as sharp as a razor blade. I want to see you grow up, and don't ever change. I put my hand on the top of her head. It would get pretty crowded, Fizz, I say.
I'd move into the ocean, Izzy says matter-of-factly.
I used to lie here like this all summer long, I tell her. I'd come up here and just stare at the sky. She rolls over on her back, so she's staring up as well.
But this view hasn't changed much, has it?
What she says is so simple, I almost laugh. She's right, of course. No, this looks exactly the same. I suppose that's the secret. If you're ever wishing for things to go back to the way they were, you just have to look up. Through the dark. I check my phone when I get home. 3 new text messages. Lindsay, Elodie, and Allie have each texted me the exact same thing. Cupiday, love you. They were probably together when they sent it. That's a thing we sometimes do, type up and send the exact same messages at exactly the same time. It's stupid, but it makes me smile. I don't reply, though. In the morning, I sent Lindsay a text letting her know she should go to school without me, but even though we're not fighting today, I felt weird tacking our usual XXO at the end. Somewhere in some alternate time or place or life or something, I'm still mad at her, and she's mad at me. It amazes me how easy it is for things to change, how easy it is to start off down the same road you always take and wind up somewhere new. Just one false step, one pause, one detour, and you end up with new friends or a bad reputation or a boyfriend or a breakup. It's never occurred to me before. I've never been able to see it, and it makes me feel weirdly like maybe all of these different possibilities exist at the same time, like each moment we live has 1,000 other moments layered underneath it that look different. Maybe Lindsay and I are best friends and we hate each other both. Maybe I'm only one math class away from being a slut like Anna Cartullo. Maybe I am like her, deep down. Maybe we all are. Just one lunch period away from eating alone in the bathroom. I wonder if it's ever really possible to know the truth about someone else, or if the best we can do is just stumble into each other, heads down, hoping to avoid collision. I think of Lindsay in the bathroom of Rosalita's and wonder how many people are clutching secrets like little fists, like rocks sitting in the pits of their stomachs. All of them, maybe. The fourth text is from Rob, and it just says, "Are you sick?" I delete it and then shut off my phone. Izzy and I spend the rest of the afternoon watching old DVDs, mostly old Disney and Pixar movies we both love, like The Little Mermaid and Finding Nemo. We make popcorn with extra butter and Tabasco sauce, the way my dad always makes it, and hunker down in the den with all the lights off while the sky outside grows darker and the trees start to whip around in the wind. When my mom comes home, we petition her for a Formaggio Friday. We used to go to the same Italian restaurant every Friday night, and that's what we called it, because the restaurant, which had checked red and white plastic tablecloths and an accordion player and fake plastic roses on the tables, was so cheesy, and she says she'll think about it, which means we're going. It's been forever since I've been at home on a weekend night. And when my dad comes home and sees Izzy and me piled on the couch, he staggers through the door, clutching at his heart like he's having a heart attack.
"Is it a hallucination?" he says, setting down his briefcase. "Could it be? Samantha Kingston, home, on a Friday?"
I roll my eyes. "I don't know. Did you do a lot of acid in the 60s? Could be a flashback."
"I was 2 years old in 1960. I came too late for the party."
He leans down and pecks me on the head. I pull away out of habit.
"And I'm not even going to ask how you know about acid flashbacks."
"What's an acid flashback?"
Izzy crows. "Nothing." My dad and I say at the same time, and he smiles at me. We do end up going to Formaggio's, official name, Luigi's Italian Home Kitchen, which actually isn't Formaggio's or Luigi's anymore and hasn't been for years. 5 years ago, a sushi restaurant moved in and replaced all of the fake Art Deco tiles and glass lanterns with sleek metal tables and a long oak bar. It doesn't matter, though. It will always be Formaggio's to me. The restaurant is super crowded, but we get one of the best tables right next to the big tanks of exotic fish that sit next to the windows. As usual, my dad makes a bad joke about how much he loves seafood restaurants, and my mother tells him to stick to architecture and leave comedy to the professionals. At dinner, my mom's extra nice to me because she thinks I'm going through breakup trauma, and Izzy and I order half the menu and wind up full on edamame and shrimp shumai and tempura and seaweed salad before the meal even comes. My dad has 2 beers and gets tipsy and entertains us with stories about crazy clients, and my mom keeps telling me to order whatever I want, and Izzy puts a napkin over her head and pretends to be a pilgrim tasting California rolls for the first time. Up until then, it's a good day. One of the best. Close to perfect, really, even though nothing special happened at all. I guess I've probably had a lot of days like this, but somehow they're never the ones you remember. That seems wrong to me now. I think of lying in Allie's house in the dark and wondering whether I've ever had a day worth reliving. It seems to me like living this one again and again wouldn't be so bad, and I imagine that's what I'll do. Just go on like this, over and over, until time winds completely down, until the universe stops. Just before we get our dessert, a big group of freshmen and sophomores I recognize from Jefferson come filing in. A few of them are still wearing JV swim jackets. They must have had a late meet. They seem so young, hair scraped away from their faces, ponytails, no makeup, totally different from the way they look when they show up to our parties, when it looks like they've just spent an hour and a half getting freebies at the Mac counter. A couple of them catch me staring and drop their eyes. Green tea and red bean ice cream? The waitress sets down a big bowl and 4 spoons in front of us. Izzy goes to town on the red bean. My dad groans and puts a hand on his stomach.
I don't know how you can still be hungry.
Growing girl! Izzy opens her mouth, showing off the ice cream mushed on her tongue. Gross, Izzy! I pick up my spoon and scoop a little bit from the green tea side.
Sykes! Hey, Sykes!
I whip around at the sound of her name. One of the swim team girls is half standing out of her chair waving. I scan the restaurant looking for Juliet, but there's only one person at the door. She's thin and pale and very blonde, and she's standing and shaking her shoulders to get the rain off her jacket. It takes me a second to recognize her, but as she turns a complete circle looking for her friends, I do. The Cupid from math class. The angel who delivered my roses. When she sees the rest of her teammates, she raises her hand briefly and gives a quick flutter of her fingers. Then she starts threading her way over to them, and as she moves past our table, I catch a glimpse of her neon blue and orange swim jacket, and it's like the whole room goes still and only those 5 letters remain, lit up like signs. S-Y-K-E-S. Sykes. Juliet's little sister.
Earth to Thammy!
Izzy is poking me with the butt end of her spoon. Your ice cream's getting melty. Not hungry anymore. I put my spoon down and push away from the table.
Where are you going?
Mom reaches out and puts her hand on my wrist, but I barely feel it. 5 minutes. And then I'm walking over to the swim team table, the whole time staring at the pale girl and her heart-shaped face. I can't believe I didn't see the resemblance before. They've got the same wide-spaced blue eyes, the same translucent skin and pale lips. Then again, until recently, I've never really looked at Juliet, even though I must have seen her 10,000 times. The swim team girls have gotten their menus, and they're laughing and swatting each other. I distinctly hear one of them say Rob's name, probably saying how cute he looks in his lacrosse jersey. I should know, I used to say it all the time. I've never cared less about anything. When I'm about 4 feet away from the table, one of them spots me, and instantly the whole table goes silent. The girl who was talking about Rob goes the color of the menu she's holding. Little Sykes is squeezed in at the very end of the table. I walk directly up to her. Hey. Now that I'm standing here, I'm not exactly sure why I came over. The funniest part about it is that I'm the one who's nervous. What's your name? Did I do something? Her voice is actually trembling. The rest of the girls aren't helping. They're looking at me like they expect at any second I'm going to lunge forward and swallow her head or something. No, I give her a small smile. Now that I see it, the resemblance between her and Juliet unnerves me. You have an older sister, right? Her mouth tightens into a thin line, and her eyes go cloudy like she's putting up a wall. I don't blame her. She probably thinks I'm going to pick on her for having a freak for a big sister. It must happen a lot. But she tilts up her chin and stares at me straight in the eye. Kind of reminds me of something Izzy would do. Fam's not going to school, and I'm not going either. Yeah. Juliet Sykes. Then she waits patiently, waits for me to start laughing. Her eyes are so steady I look down. Yeah, I know Juliet. You do? She raises her eyebrows. Well, kind of. All the girls are staring at me now. I have a feeling they're having a hard time keeping their jaws from dropping open. She's kind of my lab partner. I figure this is a safe bet. Science is mandatory and everybody gets assigned lab partners. Juliet's sister's face relaxes a little bit. Juliet's really good at bio. I mean, she's really good at school. She lets herself smile. I'm Marion. Hey. Marion is a good name for her, a pure name, somehow. My palms are sweating. I wipe them on my jeans. I'm Sam. Marion drops her eyes and says shyly, I know who you are. Two arms circle around my waist. Izzy has come up behind me. The point of her chin pokes me in the side. Ice cream's almost gone, she says. You sure you don't want any? Marion smiles at Izzy. What's your name? Elizabeth, Izzy says proudly, then sags a little. But everybody calls me Izzy. When I was little, everybody called me Mary. Marion makes a face, but now everybody calls me Marion. I don't mind Izzy that much, Izzy says, chewing on her lip like she's just decided it. Marion looks up at me. You have a little sister too, huh? Suddenly, I can't stand to look at her. I can't stand to think about what will happen later. I know. The stillness of the house, the gunshot. And then what? Will she be the first one down the stairs? Will that final image of her sister be the one that lasts, that wipes out whatever other memories she's stored up over the years? I go into a panic, trying to think what kind of memories Izzy has of me, will have of me. Come on, Izzy, let's let the girls eat. My voice is trembling, but I don't think anyone notices. I pat Izzy on the head, and she gallops back toward our table. The girls at the table are getting more confident now. Smiles are sprouting up, and they're all looking at me in awe, like they can't believe how nice I'm being, like I've given them a present. I hate it. They should hate me. If they knew what kind of person I was, they would hate me, I'm sure of it. I don't know why Kent pops into my head right then, but he does. He would hate me too if he knew everything. The realization makes me strangely upset. Tell Juliet not to do it! I blurt out and then can't believe I've said it. Marion wrinkles her forehead. Do what? Science project thing, I say quickly and then add. She'll know what I'm talking about. Okay. Marion's beaming at me. I start to turn away, but she calls me back. Sam. I turn around and she claps her hand over her mouth and giggles like she can't believe she had the courage to say my name. I'll have to tell her tomorrow, she says. Juliet's going out tonight. She says it like she's saying Juliet's going to be valedictorian. I can just picture the scene. Mom and Dad and sister downstairs, Juliet locked in her bedroom as usual, blasting music alone, and then, miracle of miracles, she descends, hair swept back, confident, cool, announcing she's headed to a party. They must have been so happy, so proud, their lonely little girl making good at the end of senior year. To Kent's party, to find Lindsay, to find me, to be pushed and tripped and soaked with beer. The sushi's not sitting so well with me all of a sudden. If they had any idea. I'll definitely tell her tomorrow, though. Marion beams at me, a headlight bearing down at me through the dark. All the way home, I'm trying to forget Marion Sykes. When my dad wishes me good night, he's always ready to pass out after a beer, and tonight he had, gasp, two. I'm trying to forget Marion Sykes. When Izzy comes in half an hour later, showered and clean-smelling in her ratty Dora PJs and plants a sloppy, wet kiss on my cheek, I'm trying to forget her. And an hour after that, when my mother stands at my door and says, "I'm proud of you, Sam," I'm still thinking of her. My mother goes to bed. Silence fills the house. Somewhere in the deep darkness, a clock is ticking, and when I close my eyes, I picture Juliet Sykes coming toward me calmly, her shoes tapping against a wood floor, blood flowing from her eyes. I sit up in bed, heart pounding. Then I get up, find my North Face in the dark. This morning, I swore that there was nothing in the world that could make me go back to Kent's party, but here I am, tiptoeing down the stairs, edging along in the dark hallways, sneaking my mom's keys off the shelf in the mudroom. She's been amazingly human today, but the last thing I need to deal with is some big conversation of the "what makes me think I can cut school and then go out" variety. I try to tell myself that Juliet Sykes isn't really my problem, but I keep imagining how horrible it would be if this were her day, if she had to live it over and over again. I think pretty much everybody, even Juliet Sykes, deserves to die on a better day than that. The hinges on the back and front door squawk so loudly they might as well be alarm clocks. Sometimes I think my parents have engineered this deliberately. In the kitchen, I carefully spill some olive oil on a paper towel and I rub this onto the hinges on the back door. Lindsay taught me this trick. She's always developing new, better ways to sneak out, even though she has no curfew and it doesn't matter one way or the other when she leaves and when she comes home. I think she misses that, actually. I think that's why she's always meticulous about the details. She likes to pretend that she has to be. The door with its Italian-seasoned hinges swings open with barely a whisper, and I'm out. I haven't really thought through why I'm heading to Kent's or what I'm going to do once I'm there, and instead of driving there directly, I find myself turning on random streets and dead-end cul-de-sacs, circling up and down. The houses are mostly set back from the street, and lit windows appear magically in the dark like hanging lanterns. It's amazing how different everything looks at night, almost unrecognizable, especially in the rain. Houses sit hulking back on their lawns, brooding and alive. It looks so different from the ridge view of the day, when everything is clean and polished and trimmed neatly, when everything unfolds in an orderly way, husbands heading to their cars with coffee mugs, wives following soon after, dressed in Pilates gear, tiny girls in Baby Gap dresses and car seats and Lexus SUVs and Starbucks cups and normalcy. I wonder which one is the true version. There are hardly any cars on the road. I keep crawling along at 15 miles per hour. I'm looking for something, but I don't know what. I pass Elodie's street and keep going. Each street lamp casts a neat funnel of light downward, illuminating the inside of the car briefly before I'm left again in darkness. My headlights sweep over a crooked green street sign 50 feet ahead. Serenity Place. I suddenly remember sitting in Allie's kitchen freshman year while her mom chattered on the phone endlessly, pacing back and forth on the deck in bare feet and yoga pants. "She's getting her daily dose of gossip," Allie had said, rolling her eyes. "Mindy Sachs is better than Us Weekly." And Lindsay had put in how ironic it was that Ms. Sachs lived on Serenity Place,
Like she doesn't bring the noise with her?
And it was the first time I really understood the meaning of the word ironic. I yank my wheel at the last second and brake, rolling down Serenity Place. It's not a long street. There are no more than 24 houses on it, and like many streets in Ridgeview, ends in a cul-de-sac. My heart leaps when I see a silver Saab parked neatly in one of the driveways. The license plate reads, Mom of Four. That's Ms. Sack's car. I must be close. The next house down is number 59. It is marked with a tin mailbox in the shape of a rooster, which stretches up from a flower bed that is, at this point in the year, no more than a long patch of black dirt. Sykes is printed along the rooster's wing in letters so small you have to be looking before you can see them. I can't really explain it, but I feel like I would have known the house anyway. There's nothing wrong with it. It's no different from any other house. Not the biggest, not the smallest, decently taken care of. White paint, dark shutters, a single light burning downstairs. But there's something else. Some quality I can't really identify that makes it look like the house is too big for itself. Like something inside is straining to get out. Like the whole place is about to bust its seams. It's a desperate house, somehow. I turn into the driveway. I have no business being here, I know that, but I can't help it. It's like something's tugging me inside. The rain is coming down hard, and I grab an old sweatshirt from the back seat, Izzy's, probably, and use it to shield my head as I sprint from the car to the front porch, my breath clouding in front of me. Before I can think too much about what I'm doing, I ring the doorbell. It takes a long time for someone to answer the door, and I do a little jog, my breath steaming out in front of me, trying to stay warm. Finally, there's a shuffling sound from inside, and then a scraping of hinges. The door swings open, and a woman stands there, blinking at me confusedly. Juliet's mother. She's wearing a bathrobe, which she holds closed with one hand. She is as thin as Juliet and has the same clear blue eyes and pale skin as both of her daughters. Looking at her, I am reminded of a wisp of smoke curling up into the dark.
Can I help you?
Her voice is very soft. I'm kind of thrown. For some reason, I expected Marion would be the one to come to the door. My name is Samantha Kingston. I'm looking for Juliet. Because it worked the first time, I add. She's my lab partner. From inside, a man, Juliet's father, I guess, shouts,
Who is it?
The voice is barking and loud and so different from Mrs. Sykes' voice, I unconsciously shuffle backward. Mrs. Sykes jumps a little and turns her head quickly, inadvertently swinging the door open an extra couple of inches. The hallway behind her is dark. Swampy blue and green shadows dance up one wall, images projected from a television in a room I can't see.
It's no one. She says quickly, her voice directed into the darkness behind her. It's for Juliet.
Juliet! Someone's here for Juliet!
He sounds exactly like a dog.
Bark, 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 bark.
I fight a wild, nervous urge to laugh.
I'll take care of it.
Mrs. Sykes turns back to me. Again, the door swings closed with her movement as though she is leaning on it for support. Her smile doesn't quite reach her eyes.
Juliet's not home right now. Is there something I can help you with?
I missed school today. We had this big assignment. I trail off helplessly, starting to regret having come. Despite my north face, I'm shivering like a maniac. I must look like a maniac, too, hopping from foot to foot, holding a sweatshirt over my head for an umbrella. Mrs. Sykes seems to notice, finally, that I'm standing in the rain.
Why don't you come in?
She says and steps backward into the hall. I follow her inside. An open door to the left leads directly off the hall. That's where the television is. I can just make out an armchair and the silhouette of someone sitting there, the edge of an enormous jaw touched with blue from the screen. I remember what Lindsay said then about Juliet's dad being an alcoholic. I vaguely remember hearing that same rumor and something else, too. That there'd been an accident? Something about semi-paralysis or pills or something?
I wish I'd paid more attention. Mrs. Sykes catches me looking and walks quickly over to the door, pulling it shut. It is now so dark I can barely see, and I realize I'm still cold. If the heat is on in the house, I can't feel it. From the TV room, I hear the sounds of a horror film scream and the steady, syncopated rhythm of machine gun fire. Now I'm definitely regretting coming. For a second, I have this wild fantasy that Juliet comes from a whole family of crazy serial killers, and that at any second, Mrs. Sykes is going to go Silence of the Lambs on me. The whole family's whacked. That's what Lindsay had said. The darkness is pressing all around me, stifling, and I almost cry out with gratitude when Mrs. Sykes switches on a light and the hall appears lit up and normal and not full of dead human trophies or something. There's a dried flower arrangement on a side table decorated with lace next to a framed family photo. I wish I could look at it more closely. Was it important, this assignment? Mrs. Sykes asks almost in a whisper. She shoots a nervous glance in the direction of the TV room, and I wonder if she thinks she's being too loud. I kind of promised Juliet I would pick up some stuff for our makeup presentation on Monday. I try to lower my voice, but she still winces. I thought Juliet said she would be home tonight. Juliet went out, she says, and then, as if she's unused to saying the words and is testing them on her tongue, repeats, "She went out, but maybe she left it for you?" "I could look for it," I say. "I want to see her room, I realize. That's why I'm here. I need to see it." "She probably just dumped it on her bed or something." I try to sound casual, like Juliet and I are on really good terms with each other, like it's not weird for me to waltz into her house at 10:30 on a Friday night and try to weasel my way into her bedroom. Mrs. Sykes hesitates. "Maybe I can call her cell phone," she says, and then adds apologetically, "Juliet hates to have anyone in her room." "You don't have to call her," I say quickly. "Juliet will probably tell her mom to sic the cops on me. It's not that important. I'll pick it up tomorrow."
No, I'll call her. It will just take a second."
Juliet's mom is already disappearing into the kitchen. It's amazing how quickly and soundlessly she moves, like an animal slipping in and out of the shadows. I consider jetting out while she's in the kitchen. I think about going home, crawling into bed, watching old movies on my computer. Maybe I'll make a pot of coffee and sit up all night long. If I never go to sleep, maybe today will have to turn into tomorrow. I wonder idly how long I can go without sleep before I flip my shit and start running down the street in my underwear, hallucinating purple spiders. But instead, I just stand there, waiting. There's nothing else to do, so I take a few steps forward and bend down to look at the photograph on the table. For a second, I'm confused. It's a picture of an unfamiliar woman, probably 25 or 30, with her arms wrapped around a good-looking guy in a flannel shirt. The colors are all saturated and technicolor bright, and the couple looks perfect, sparkling, all white teeth and dazzling smiles and beautiful brown hair. Then I see the words printed in the lower bottom corner of the picture, "Shadowcast Images, Inc.," and realize that this isn't even a real family photo. It's one of the generic pictures that gets sold along with the picture frame, a shiny, happy advertisement for all the shiny, happy moments you can capture forever inside the 5x7 sterling silver frame with butterfly detail. No one has bothered to replace it. Or maybe the Sykes family doesn't have too many shiny, happy moments to remember. I pull away quickly, wishing I hadn't looked. Even though it's just a picture of two models, I feel weirdly like I've seen something way too personal, like I've accidentally caught a glimpse of someone's inner thigh or nose hairs or something. Mrs. Sykes still isn't back, so I wander out of the hall into the living room on the right. It is mostly dark, and it's all plaids and lace and dried flowers. It looks as though it hasn't been redecorated since the 50s. There's a single dull light shining near the window, casting a circular reflection on the black pane of glass, a version of the room appearing in miniature there. And a face, a screaming face pressed up against the window.
I let out a squeak of fear before I realized that this, too, is a reflection. There's a mask mounted on a table just in front of the window facing outward. I go over to it and lift it carefully from its perch. It's a woman's face crafted from newspaper and red stitching, which is crisscrossed over the skin-like, horrible scars. Words run up the bridge of the nose and across the forehead, certain headlines visible or halfway visible, like Beauty Remedy and Tragedy Strikes, and little scraps of paper are unfurling from various places on her face like she's molting. The mouth and the eyes are cut completely away, and when I lift the mask to my face, it fits well. The reflection in the window is awful. I look like something diseased or a monster from a horror movie. I can't look away. Juliet made that. The voice behind me makes me jump. Mrs. Sykes has reappeared and is leaning against the door, frowning at me. I pop the mask off, return it quickly to its perch. I'm so sorry, I saw it and I just wanted to try it on. I finish lamely. Mrs. Sykes comes over and rearranges the mask, straightening it, making sure it's aligned correctly.
When Juliet was younger, she was always drawing, always sketching or painting something or sewing her own dresses.
Mrs. Sykes shrugs, flutters a hand.
I don't think she's very interested in that stuff now. Did you talk to Juliet?
I ask nervously, waiting for her to kick me out. Mrs. Sykes blinks at me several times as though trying to squeeze me into focus.
Juliet, she repeats and then shakes her head. I called her phone a couple of times. She didn't answer. She doesn't usually go out on the weekends.
Mrs. Sykes looks at me helplessly.
I'm sure she's fine,
I say as cheerfully as I can, feeling like each word is a knife going down into my stomach.
She probably didn't hear her phone.
Suddenly, the thing I want most of all is to get out of there. I can't stand to lie to Mrs. Sykes. She looks so sad, standing in her nightgown, ready for bed, as though she's already asleep, sort of. That's what the whole house feels like, as though it's wrapped up in a heavy sleep, the kind that stifles you, won't let you wake, drags you back into the sheets, drowning, even when you fight it. I imagine Juliet sneaking up to her room in the dark, and the silence. Through the atmosphere of sleep so thick it feels solid, the lullaby of creaking floorboards and quietly hissing radiators, the slow revolutions of people orbiting wordlessly around one another, and then... bang! Mrs. Sykes walks me back to the front hall.
You can come by tomorrow, she says. I'm sure Juliet will have everything ready by then. She's usually very responsible. A good girl.
Sure. Tomorrow. I don't even like to say the word, and I wave a quick goodbye before dashing once again through the dark to my car. It's even colder than it was earlier. The rain, half ice, pings off the hood of my car as I sit there, waiting for the engine to warm up, blowing on my hands and shivering, grateful to be out of there. As soon as I'm out of the house, a weight eases up off my chest like the atmosphere and pressure inside is different, heavier. My first impression was right. It really is a desperate house. I see Juliet's mom silhouetted by the window. I wonder if she's waiting for me to leave or for her daughter to come home. That's when I make a decision. I know what I'll do. I'll go to Kent's house and I'll catch Juliet, and if I have to, I will hit her in the face. I'll make her see how stupid the whole death idea is. It's certainly no picnic for me. If it comes down to it, I'll tie her up in the back of my car so she can't get her hands on the gun. I realize I've never really done something good for someone else, at least not for a while. I volunteer sometimes for Meals on Wheels, but that's because colleges like that kind of thing. BU especially mentioned charity on the application portion of their website. And obviously, I'm nice to my friends, and I give great birthday gifts. I once spent a month and a half collecting cow-shaped salt shakers to give to Allie because she loves cows and salt. I don't usually do good things just for the hell of it.
This will be my good thing.
Then I have a glimmer of an idea. I remember when we were studying Dante in English, and Ben Gowan kept asking if the souls in purgatory ever got cast down into hell. Ben Gowan once got suspended for 3 days for drawing a picture of a bomb blowing up our cafeteria and all of these decapitated heads flying everywhere, so for him the question was normal. And Mrs. Harbour went off on one of her tangents and said that no, that wasn't possible, but that some modern Christian thinkers believed you could go up from purgatory into heaven once you'd done enough time there. I've never really believed in heaven. It always sounded like a crazy idea. Everybody happy and reunited, Fred Astaire and Einstein doing a tango on the clouds, that kind of stuff. But then again, I never really believed I'd have to relive one day forever, either. It's no crazier than what's already happened to me. Maybe the whole point is I have to prove that I'm a good person. Maybe I have to prove that I deserve to move on. Maybe Juliet Sykes is the only thing between me and an eternity of chocolate fountains and perfect love and guys who always call when they say they will and banana sundaes that actually help you burn calories. Maybe she's my ticket out.